From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. U.S. UN Ambassador Nikki Haley announced new economic sanctions targeting Russian companies that enable Syria's chemical weapons production. And she defended Saturday's missile strikes launched by the U.S., Britain, and France, targeting Syria's chemical weapons infrastructure.
This was a very strong response. I mean, first of all, we went after their storage facilities where they kept components. We went after their massive research facility, which was the heart of their chemical weapons program, and we went after their production facility. So this was a very strong attack on the chemical weapons program.
Haley said sanctions are meant to send a message to Moscow, which she said has blocked previous UN efforts to investigate uses of chemical weapons. Washington Institute for Near East Policy distinguished scholar James Jeffrey said it's too early to determine the success of Saturday's strikes.
We don't know. They had only one purpose, which was to convince Assad that it is not a good idea to continue chemical attacks.
The U.S., Britain, and France launched more than 100 missiles early Saturday, targeting three chemical weapons facilities. Syria denies having such weapons and denounced Saturday's strike as an act of aggression.
Oui, il y a 10 jours, le président.
In a Sunday interview, French President Emmanuel Macron said he convinced President Donald Trump to stay in Syria for the long term. But late Sunday, the White House indicated Mr. Trump still wants to pull U.S. forces out as quickly as possible. Meanwhile, inspectors from the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons have launched an investigation into the April 7th chemical attack in Douma. The French military Sunday said about 15 militants were killed in Saturday's attack on a UN base in the ancient city Timbuktu in northern Mali, one UN peacekeeper killed in the four-hour rocket mortar and car bombing attack near the city's airport. This is VOA News. Meeting in Dhahran, Saudi Arabia Sunday, 17 members of the Arab League called for an international investigation into the use of those chemical weapons in Syria. It also condemned Iranian interference in the internal affairs of other Arab states and criticized the U.S. decision to move its embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. North Korea's state-run news agency has said leader Kim Jong-un received visiting senior Chinese diplomat Song Tao Saturday, a meeting that followed Mr. Kim's surprise visit to Beijing last month, indicating closer ties. Those ties have been strained in recent years over the North's pursuit of a nuclear arsenal. The North Korean leader is set to meet South Korean President Moon Jae-in April 27th and has a proposed meeting with President Trump, although the time and venue have yet to be determined. In Montenegro, pro-European Union politician Milo Djukanovic swept back to power Sunday, pledging to keep the tiny Balkan country on the European path after joining NATO last year. Mr. Djukanovic told his supporters, "We have fulfilled our promise, an important victory for the country's European future." He won about 54% of the vote in preliminary results from Sunday's ballot, thus avoiding a runoff. It was the first national vote since joining the Western Alliance in December. In the Spanish city Barcelona, hundreds of thousands supporting Catalan independence rallied Sunday, demanding the release of jailed Catalonian leaders. The crowd shouting Puigdemont for president, referring to exiled leader Carles Puigdemont. Many waved Catalan flags and wore yellow as a sign of solidarity with the jailed separatists. Last week, a German court dismissed a Spanish extradition request for Puigdemont and released him on bail. Catalonia has been in political limbo since Madrid imposed direct rule after it unilaterally declared independence in October. Israel Sunday freed more than 200 African migrants from prison after the government failed to finalize a plan to deport them, and tens of thousands of mostly Sudanese and Eritreans. The government, facing court challenges, has been in negotiations with Uganda, but was unable to reach a deadline set by the Israeli Supreme Court. Eritrean Waldab Gabriel asked why he should agree to be sent to Uganda. "That's not my country," he said. Early this month, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu canceled a deal with the UN to relocate about half the nearly 40,000 African migrants, while leaving the rest to stay in Israel indefinitely. Former U.S. Marine-turned-Hollywood actor R. Lee Ermey, the most famous for his role as drill sergeant in the movie Full Metal Jacket, has died. Ermey was 74. The Kansas native died from complications of pneumonia. The Vietnam veteran also appeared in the films Apocalypse Now and The Boys in Company C. Ermey also hosted History Channel series Mail Call and Lock and Load. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I am Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Today is Monday, April 16th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari is set to meet U.S. President Donald Trump at the White House later on this month. The meeting comes weeks after former U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson visited Nigeria and other African countries in March of this year. And in Malawi, the ruling Democratic Progressive Party, or DPP, is divided over who is going to be their presidential candidate during next year's elections. Members of the party in the northern region have supported the suggestion to have Vice President Saulos Chilima as the next president.
He has worked for several organizations. He has lived in Malawi throughout his life. So I'm thinking that the skills that he has acquired through the job that he has performed as an ordinary person should be easily transferred to the presidential role.
That's Malawi's former First Lady, Calista Mutharika, on her support for Vice President Saulos Chilima. In South Africa, millions said an emotional goodbye to anti-apartheid icon Winnie Madikizela-Mandela on Saturday during her official funeral, with supporters fiercely defending her complex legacy.
South Africa being an incredibly patriarchal society, and there's a great deal of sexism about her being a woman who refused to be identified by her husband. So she used to say very firmly that she never had any intention of being a first lady, or she never had any intention of being defined by Nelson Mandela, and she resisted that at every.
That is Sitembile Mbete, a young South African political scientist. She was speaking to me from South Africa. Gabon President Ali Bongo ended his one-day visit in Burundi's capital, Bujumbura. Those stories plus Samson Omalley's sports coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Gabon President Ali Bongo ended his one-day visit in Burundi's capital, Bujumbura, where he met President Pierre Nkurunziza. The visit comes as Burundi is set to conduct a referendum and deteriorating relations with its neighbor, Rwanda, since 2015. Moses Havyarimana reports from Bujumbura.
After his one-day visit in Bujumbura, where he met his counterpart, Pierre Nkurunziza, the Gabon President Ali Bongo said that his visit was part of the efforts to stabilize the region and find out the solution to the region's current problems. He says that he met President Pierre Nkurunziza and that they discussed on the problems the region is currently facing. He said that his part of the visit is among which he visited other countries in the region to understand the problems of the region and every country in particular. Ali Bongo Ondimba is currently the chairman of the Economic Community of Central African States, a regional bloc that involves 11 countries. The Gabon president tour began in February, where he had already met 8 presidents of the member countries, including Rwanda. He says that it is clear that if they want economic development, the region has to be peaceful and stable. Burundi is set to conduct a referendum on 17th next month, despite being criticized by the international community on reviewing the constitution. Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza said that it is only Burundians who will decide as the state is sovereign. He says that issues regarding elections concern Burundians and that the region just have to follow and support as it has always been doing in other countries. He says that upcoming referendum is not of a kind that should attract the attention of the region since the exercise is for Burundians. Early this month, Burundi government accused Kigali of holding Burundian refugees hostage and militarily training them to oust Nkurunziza's government, the allegations that Rwandan government has denied. The UNHCR chief, Filippo Grandi, while in Bujumbura earlier on, said that a dialogue framework will be put in place between the two countries.
We will work to establish a better framework for discussion between Rwanda, Burundi, and UNHCR on the refugees there. And I'm confident that we will go towards a more constructive engagement.
Burundi's Independent Electoral Commission revealed that campaigns for the referendum will kick off on 1st May this year, a move that will see the country amending the constitution for the first time since 2005. Moses Habyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
This Saturday, South Africans laid to rest anti-apartheid icon Winnie Madikizela Mandela. Thousands filled Soweto Stadium to pay their respects to one of the country's most prominent figures of South Africa's anti-apartheid movement. Among those remembering the legacy of Winnie Mandela is Sitembile Mbete, a young South African political scientist. And from Johannesburg, South Africa, she talks to me about why Winnie Mandela will always be remembered as a symbol of the struggle against apartheid, but also says that some of the questions about her legacy can be attributed to a patriarchal society that refuses to acknowledge that a woman played such an important role in the liberation of her people.
I think Winnie Madikizela Mandela was so important in South African history for being the face of the liberation struggle after the African National Congress and other liberation movements were banned in 1961, and really keeping the name of Nelson Mandela alive in South Africa by being the leader of the Release Nelson Mandela campaign, and mobilizing both local and international interest in the conditions of Black South Africans under apartheid. In many ways, she was the most feared anti-apartheid activist in South Africa for 30 years. The apartheid government kept her under constant surveillance.
How much is the negation of her contribution to the end of apartheid have to do with the fact that she was a woman?
Certainly, there is so much about the way in which Winnie Mandela has been criticized that is about South Africa being an incredibly patriarchal society. And there's a great deal of sexism about her being a woman who refused to be identified by her husband. So she used to say very firmly that she never had any intention of being a first lady, or she never had any intention of being defined by Nelson Mandela. And she resisted that at every And she was very militant. And I think a lot of the negative criticism of her is because that's not the way women are supposed to behave. Mm-hmm. And in a South African society that has such stark gender roles, culturally and also in terms of religion, because South Africans are very religious and very Christian, of different Christian denominations, she defied all expectations of how women are supposed to behave. And I think that a lot of the criticism of her comes from that.
Sitembile Mbete is a South African political scientist. I spoke to her from Johannesburg, South Africa. So can today's Generation Z change the world? Well, that's a question that each generation before them is constantly asking themselves. Generation Z are young people who were born after 1994. And the worry is that they are too indifferent and distracted to care about today's global issues. The worry is that due to their excessive screen time on social media, they are too distracted to care. But a new global campaign hopes to dispel that as a myth. The campaign seeks to merge pop culture and social impact by inspiring 2 billion acts of good by 2030 in support of the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. One of the influencers hoping to mobilize young people is Adebola Williams, an activist based in Lagos, Nigeria. He tells me that the campaign is rooted in the truth that exponential change can be made possible by little individual acts.
The easiest for a generation that is focused on pop culture and media is to then get influencers who are the guys who have influence over this generation. If a Beyonce says, turn off that light before you walk out the door, you have many of the millennials jumping to do that. So it's really to then find who are the drivers of pop culture. You know, so how do you merge pop culture with social impact?
Many people are saying that this generation is a little distracted with pop culture, with technology on Instagram, Facebook, and all these things, that they're too distracted to care. How can they become change makers?
So the thing is, it's all about perspective. What people have looked upon as the negativity is the same thing that you need to turn around to positivity. You know, so it's all about perspective. The same pop culture is what you have to engage, or you need to engage it using, you know, knowledge of the generation you're dealing with. I find many times some people are even too lazy to try and pay attention to understand the millennial generation. Every generation has their own tool. This generation, the currency of this generation is talent. Talent is the currency of this generation. And so because talent is that generation, a lot of them are expressive talent, music, fashion, you know, poetry, and all of those things. Now, whoever wants to engage that audience needs to spend time understanding what makes that audience speak, what makes that audience act. So you need to understand what is the message. When you identify your agenda, you have to identify the message and the platform to shape that conversation in a way they will listen to you and ultimately provoke action. But I find that sometimes people are just brands, causes might just be too lazy to spend that time, you know, to be able to feed that generation. NGOs need to begin to frame their message in a way that will provoke the generation to action. Using pop culture and the media.
Okay, so using pop culture and the media in a way to get their attention.
Yeah, because these guys are media natives.
Right.
That's where they live on social media.
Mm.
On social media, you know, when we say change in 6 seconds, it's because it's a generation that's quick, sharp, short, and simple. So on social media, it's one photo character, it's one image. So a powerful image of somebody doing something you want them to emulate is short, quick text of something you want them to do. It's a generation that is moving really fast. So you have to work with them at the pace.
So what does a better world look like for a Generation Z, well, 20 years from now? Because I think 2030 is the goal, is the target year for when this campaign ends. What does the world look like, or what do you want it to look like at that point?
The world of equality, young, woman, man, whatever you are, whatever your choices are, a world of equality, you know, will be very key for a future for this generation in question.
And so if young people are listening to us in Africa right now, around the continent, what are you telling them to start off by doing today?
Today, turn up that light. You know, Africa has energy issues, first of all. So if you can save and not even overburn the energy you have, you know, you're already even doing something good. So always switch off the light as you leave your home. That's the basic, the most basic. Dispose refuse properly. Separate, you know, the recyclables, you know, from the others. Separate the cans, separate the leathers, the nylons, and things like that. Those are, you know, another easy. Dispose trash properly.
Social activist Adebola Williams. I spoke to him from Lagos, Nigeria. Social media users in Uganda will soon have to part with a certain fee to access the service, as the government says it will levy a charge on each social media user. But Ugandans are complaining that this will make the use of internet even more expensive than it is today. And one human rights activist says that the move amounts to double taxation. Reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji has more from Kampala.
At least 100 Uganda shillings will be charged daily on each SIM card that uses internet for social media platforms such as WhatsApp, Facebook, Twitter, Skype, Viber or Instagram. The government says to be able to raise more than 1.4 trillion Uganda shillings, or about $400 million, from the tax revenue on internet. Frank Tumwebaze, the Minister for Information and Technology, says the collected taxes will enable the government to connect other remote areas currently not having reliable internet.
When I am in Kamwenge, I cannot do that WhatsApp call because my connectivity in Kamwenge is poor. We still have 2G. Somewhere they even have 1G. So it is government's desire to make sure that connectivity becomes universal. And how do you do that? Through collection of taxes.
President Museveni recently said he was planning to introduce taxes on social media, saying people use social media for what he calls gossip, locally known as Lugambo. Kampala resident Anthony Kitale says it is unfortunate that the government is planning to add a tax on social media. Kitale, an insurance sales agent, says he relies on social media to sell his services.
It will affect our business. It will affect us from communicating with the people. These days we can't reach on to people. We can't use mailing. You can't use any other means of communication. But as other countries are using, reducing prices of internet, for us, the government is finding ways of increasing taxes through taxing such a social service.
University graduate Miriam Akelo, who hails from the northern Uganda district of Lila, says she also uses social media to look for jobs and communicate with her family back home. She says the tax on internet services will make it more expensive.
For instance, right now, I can't even make like WhatsApp calls, because if I am to do a WhatsApp call, like maybe a video call, I have to load more than enough MBs to like make up the call. Now, if the government adds on tax on what is already there, which is already expensive, I think I may not be able to afford.
Livingstone Sewanyana, the executive director of Rights Body, Foundation for Human Rights Initiative, says the government is depriving Ugandans of the right to access information. He calls it excessive taxation.
Ugandans already are paying a lot of taxes in terms of pay as you earn. We pay value-added tax on every item being purchased. We pay property tax. So in many respects, this is unnecessary burden. And secondly, it is also a measure undermining freedom of the expression.
Sewanyana suggests the government should reduce on excessive spending and fight corruption as the only viable ways to increase revenues for the nation. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Ruakarinj in Kampala, Uganda.
And in Malawi, the ruling Democratic Progressive Party, ODPP, is divided over who's going to be the presidential candidate during next year's elections. Some in the party are opting for the country's vice president, Saulos Chilima, while others want the incumbent president, Peter Mutharika, to stand as the party's presidential candidate. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
The division follows recent remarks by the country's former first lady, Kalista Mutharika, who publicly said he wants the youthful Saulos Chilima to stand as the party's presidential candidate during next year's elections. Kalista Mutharika is the wife of former president, the late Bingwa Mutharika, and a brother to the current president, Peter Mutharika.
I am attracted by the capacity that he has. He's educated, he's highly educated, he's been to university, he's an experienced chief executive officer, he has worked for several organizations, he has lived in Malawi throughout his life. So I'm thinking that the skills that he has acquired through the jobs that he has performed as an ordinary person should be easily transferred to the presidential role.
The former first lady said she supports Chilima because at 45 years of age, he is energetic enough to run the government than her in-law, President Mutharika, who will be 80 years of age during the next year's elections. Zelia Chakale is the deputy publicity secretary for the DPP. She says the party has already endorsed President Mutharika as its presidential candidate for next year's polls.
We are all strongly behind Professor Arthur Peter Mutharika, standing following the constitution of the party, which mandates the president to stand in his second term. And also as a party, we have such strong trust for our president, Professor Arthur Peter Mutharika.
Chakale told a press conference that the party will not allow anyone with an alternative choice to bring confusion in the party. Presidential spokesperson Ngeme Kalilani said President Mutharika will automatically run as the party's presidential candidate. But Chilima's spokesperson Pililani Pili refused to comment anything on the matter. Louis Ngaland is the director of youth in the DPP. He told a local radio that it's time for the ruling party to have a youthful leader.
I want to compliment the feeling of Malawians to say what they are seeing through the leadership we have currently is the reverse of things they would like to have the youthful leadership within the country now.
A youthful DPP parliamentarian, Boni Galindo, said the push for the younger blood to lead the party has the support of many party officials who will soon come in the open. However, Finance Minister Kudo Gondwe said young people cannot run the government. Gondwe, who is 82 years of age, told a local daily on Friday that running presidential office and government affairs required old people and not babies. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
And now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Good morning to you, Samson.
Good morning to you, Jackson. We begin with the Commonwealth Games, which came to a close on Sunday in Australia. Team South Africa was the highest placed African team as they finished in the sixth position with 13 gold, 11 silver and 13 bronze medals. Team Nigeria finished in the ninth position in the final medal standing, but second behind South Africa as they got 9 gold, 9 silver and 6 bronze medals with a total of 24 medals won. Kenya were 14th with 4 gold, 7 silver, 6 bronze medals, while Uganda came 15th with 3 gold, 1 silver and 2 bronze medals. But on the final day of the competition on Sunday, Hilalia Johannes made the headlines as she won Namibia's second gold medal at the Commonwealth Games when she won the women's marathon. Johannes completed the 42.2 kilometers marathon in a time of 2 hours, 32 minutes, 40 seconds to finish well ahead of second place Lisa Waitman of Australia, who came in at a time of 2 hours, 33 minutes, 23 seconds.
When I came on 19 at World Championship last year, from there I feel confident because after Commonwealth I came second position in Cape Town Marathon in September last year. From there I have courage that maybe next year at Commonwealth I will also going to make it.
In the men's category, Muyo Mutai of Uganda won the silver in a time of 2 hours, 19 minutes, 2 seconds to finish behind Australia's Michael Shirley, who won the gold medal for the second successive Commonwealth Games after he also won gold in Glasgow 4 years ago. Muyo Mutai was excited about his medal.
That's why I was happy being the position I was, reaching after 1 kilometer finishing today, I'm very happy seeing that I'm almost finishing today, finishing point.
In rugby news, the South African seven side failed to win a single medal, even though they were favourites at the Commonwealth Games, as England defeated the Blitzboks 21-14 to secure the bronze medal. Neil Powell, SA Sevens coach, says the Blitzboks just weren't good enough as they failed to make the podium at the Commonwealth Games.
Disappointed, really disappointed, especially today. I think the guys really did well last yesterday, but not good enough today.
Springbok Sevens captain Philip Seaman said his team played well on the first day, but on Sunday, when it mattered the most, they did not.
I think this team is so much better than playing in the third, fourth and actually losing the third, fourth game. So we need to go and make a couple of things right.
And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson, and have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, April 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a good day, Africa.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu, host of Health Chat. April is Autism Month in the United States, and next week on Health Chat, I will discuss autism, a range of conditions characterized by challenges with social skills, repetitive behaviors, and nonverbal communication, among other things. Our guest is Scott Badesh, President and CEO of the Autism Society of America. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The U.S. country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. Health Chat, this Tuesday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.